I have said multiple times on this show that it is more important to understand where you want your brand to go than how you want it to start, right? When you have an idea where you want your brand to go, it helps to drive all of those little decisions you have to make along the way. And in this episode, I am joined by Doc Kwan. He is full of enthusiasm. He is just lives and breathes his brand, and he is the president and CEO of one of the coolest concepts in the country, if you ask me, called Cupbop. And his story is phenomenal. He has a background in finance, and I'm not going to even spoil it here because he does a much better job explaining it. But this is what I'm talking about. Embrace your brand. Have an idea where you want it to go. And Doc wants Cupbop to go to the moon. Check it out.
Order up. Look, I'm a big believer that experience teaches. My goal with this show is to have guests to share their experience so that they can tell you what it's like, what they did right, and what they did wrong. And I'm going to share the same. Look, I'm not trying to regurgitate stuff you can find on the internet. I'm going to tell you how it really is and what it's really like to own your own place.
This is the National Restaurant Owners Podcast with your host, Kyle and Sarah.
This episode of the National Restaurant Owners Podcast is brought to you by Plate IQ, your accounts payable automation and expense management solution. As a restaurant owner, you know how important it is to stay on top of your bills. Plate IQ works with over 20,000 restaurants across the country, helping them manage and automate the full life cycle of the invoice process. Everything from general ledger coding up to and including bill payment. Plate IQ uses OCR. What's OCR, Kyle? I'm going to tell you. It's optical character recognition and deep machine learning to help eliminate manual data entry from the accounts payable process. With Plate IQ's vendor pay, you can seamlessly flow from invoice upload to paying your bills. That means you don't have to type it in. You scan it in and it does the rest of the work for you. How about that? Does that save you some time? Some headaches? With Plate IQ's vendor pay, you can also see what is due and when. Schedule payments via check, ACH, or Plate IQ card. Plus, you can even earn cash back. Yes, cash back on your invoices from over 180,000 vendors. I didn't even know there were that many vendors. That's amazing. Lastly, vendor pay is also for vendors. Keeping your vendors happy will give you leverage in negotiating your terms. Vendors participating in Plate IQ's vendor pay love it because on average, they get paid 25% faster. To learn more, head over to plateiq.com, hit request demo in the top right-hand corner, and when you're done and you love it and you're ready to sign up, mention that you heard all about Plate IQ on the National Restaurant Owners Podcast from Kyle and receive 25% off implementation. All right, this is it. We're live now.
Love it.
This is the show.
Love it. Love it.
Just starts like that. We have a dramatic countdown.
That was and then pretty
we just
dramatic.
Get right down to business. Right? It felt like something better was going to happen, but that's all it really is. It just, yeah.
Yep.
So, Doc, thank you so much for joining the show, man. And I got to tell you, I've been watching your story for quite a bit, and I'm excited to get into this with you today.
Awesome. Happy to be here. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, man. I love your energy, and I love it. It's a refreshing vibe. A lot of times you get some folks on the show, you know, in this business, and they're like, you know, deep breath, and they're kind of like, they're tough to squeeze it in, but no, your energy is refreshing.
That's what we're all about. That's what Cupbop's all about. Yeah. So got to bring the energy, man.
So if anybody who doesn't know your story, you guys were on Shark Tank.
Yes.
Let's not lead with that.
Yeah.
Let's start with where do you want to start? What's the best place to start this story? The Cupbop story.
The Cupbop story?
Doc Kwan story.
What's the Doc Kwan story? You want to know the Doc Kwan story? Okay, I'll give you the Doc Kwan story because I've got some drama in there. So
I'm gonna get my seat.
Yep. So I was born in Korea, raised in Korea until I was 11. And, you know, in the summer of 1999, our family came on a trip to the U.S., toured the West Coast for a couple weeks. I was 11 at the time. My older brother was 12. The day before we were supposed to fly back, my parents sat me and my brother down and said, oh, FYI, We're going back tomorrow. You guys are staying here.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they'd planned this. They'd planned this all along and kind of did it a very dramatic way because they thought we wouldn't want to come if they would have told us beforehand. And it was really for our future and for our education and all the opportunities that the United States, provides. And so, bam, next day they're gone and I start going to school in Utah the next month.
Wow.
And I was sixth grader. My brother was seventh grader. Went through middle school, high school in Utah, went to college. And, I was always interested in finance. My dad used to do a little bit of day trading here and there, and it looked fun. Mm. So I say, hey, what are you doing? And he kind of is like, oh, read this book. I read this book. And it was like some technical analysis, book.
Wow. Hardcore.
And so I was like, oh, that sounds fun. So I tried that, and obviously I didn't know anything. And I tried like some really, advanced stuff like options and futures and things like that. And of course I lost all my money, like emptied the account like three times in like a month. And then, I was like, I kind of really want to learn this stuff. Like I actually want to know the fundamentals instead of just trying to buy when I want and sell when I want without knowing anything. And so
that strategy wasn't working.
It wasn't working. And so I got interested in kind of finance and, in college, I thought, I gotta, what do I want to do? I want to invest. And I Googled a bunch of stuff and what's a good career where you can make a lot of money, but it's fun, whatever. And they said hedge funds. You got to go to a hedge fund on Wall Street. And I was like, okay, that's what I need to do. And so out of school, I joined an investment bank. I joined Goldman Sachs where I did investment research for a few years, and then I did join a big hedge fund called Citadel, where I spent a number of years as an investor there, and a lot of crazy stuff on its own there. It's a crazy world.
Separate
podcast, but did that for a while. I did that for about 4.5 years at Citadel, and I was just kind of itching to try something new. At that point in my head, I was like, a couple more years of this, I'll be in my 10th year, like entering my 10th year of my career. And I was like, at that point, you just keep going that route generally, right? And so I was like, if I want to try something new, I got to do it now. And so I started just without having a clear kind of industry or whatever I wanted to get into. I just thought, okay, I got to try something new. I knew it was going to be some kind of a startup. And naturally, restaurants it's a brutal industry, as we all know. It's tooth and nail. And so as an investor, I can honestly say I had never invested in restaurants just because it's such a tough business. Honestly, never thought I was going to get into restaurants. What did happen, though, and this is where CupOp comes in. So a couple months before I left for New York, a small food truck started in Salt Lake City named CupOp. And it was CupOp Korean barbecue in a cup. And I'm Korean, so naturally I was like, what? And there's not much Korean food around in Utah.
Right.
Especially back then, there was like nothing. And so I'm like, oh, Korean food truck. Oh, yeah, let's go. So I try it and I'm like, this is awesome. This is freaking awesome. And I became a fan, avid fan, really quickly. And for the 2 months before I left for New York, I was there every time. They would come every Thursday. Bam. I was first in line. Bam, bam, bam. And it's just a brand that and a product that just stuck with me. All these years. And I thought, when I was leaving to New York, I thought, man, this brand, this product is so unique and great. If they have the right people, wow, this can really blow up to be a national brand. I just
So were you there? Quick question. Were you there checking them out like, hey, maybe I'll invest in these guys?
And no.
This is actually really good.
Not even then. I was just literally just loving the food. Like, I mean, that was, so that was, I didn't even think about that. Back then, it was just like, man, what a great product and a concept. What a unique concept. And, you know, a lot of that was obviously the food was great, but it was the energy the food truck gave off. Our founder, Jung, who, you know, who would love to be here, but he's in Korea right now, so he couldn't join. But
research.
Yeah, he used to be a break dancer. He used to be a B-boy. And so,
oh, wow.
And this is a great
coming from two different ends of the spectrum here.
Yeah. And this is a great story for him too. When he first started this cup up truck, you know, they went to their very first event. They were invited to this massive event where they sold out in like 3 hours. And he's like, oh my goodness, I'm going to get so rich. This is freaking awesome. Right. And then every event after that he went to, like, he couldn't sell anything. Nobody would come to his truck. And people were lining up in the other trucks. And he was like, what do I do? What do I do? What do I need to do? I got to get these people's attention. So he started, like, yelling and dancing in front of the truck. And so people started noticing.
That's an idea.
Yeah, people started noticing. And they're like, what's going on? So people would come and watch. People would start lining up. People would start lining up. And that's how Cup Bop got its very initial traction, was because of the energy and the these crazy people who were in this Cup Bop truck. And so it goes all the way back, you know, back to the beginning. But yeah, so we, you know, and I loved Cup Bop. And when I was doing this new kind of, you know, research on my next, you know, career move, one day it was just literally out of the blue. Cup Bop just popped in my head. I was like, oh, the Cup Bop brand. How are those guys doing? So I started looking into it. The founder's Korean. And so, you know, I was friends with him on social media. We sort of kept in touch, like, you know, just happy birthday type of thing on social media. Then I was like, huh. At that point, we had 10 brick and mortar stores and a few trucks.
Okay.
Then I was like, okay, this is probably when it gets really, really tough for restaurants.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know what? Like, you know, as an investor, I've seen a lot of company go through this, you know, growth phase, this and that. You know, I felt that I had a pretty decent skill set to be able to help out. So I just gave him a call. And I said, hey, what's going on? He was like, hey, how are you doing? You know, and I said, hey, how's Cup Bop? So he gave me all the rundown. He's like, you know, the demand is great. People love the brand. But man, we're having a tough time right now. And I was like, why? Because we have all these stores. It's getting really hard to manage. Really hard to manage. And, you know, look, they started a truck. The brand blew up. They were essentially just brute forcing one store at a time. And, you know, over time, that doesn't work, right? And like, and I would say, I think people in the industry would agree, like, once you get to kind of that seven, that's when you kind of have to almost level up, and you hit this point where it's like, okay, either you get ready for that next phase or you kind of die out. Yeah. You know? So,
yeah.
And I was like,
I mean, how big are the stores?
There are, I would say our average square footage is 1400 to 1500 square foot. So they're relatively simple to operate and they're very small. I mean, and that's one big advantage we have is that we came from a food truck. So we can, our very first store, which is our, you know, our very first store that is, you know, special and dear and near to our hearts is it's 200 square foot. It's a shack. Right. And so we have that flexibility. Wow. So anytime we can get a smaller space, we go for it, you know,
because,
you know, for me, you know, number one rule for me in restaurants and look, I've never been a restaurant guy and I've had to learn over the last 3 years. But
learn the hard way.
But for me, it's survival is always number one in restaurants. And so, and how do you survive? Well, you survive by making sure your, you know, your break evens are as low as possible. And the only thing you can really control, right? Because labor, you have minimum wage, you have this, and labor is essentially fixed as well. But that rent component is so critical. And so we try to go, even now we try to go for small spaces, right? Where we know that our chances of success are very high.
Well, I would imagine that the small footprint, a lower rent, good AUV makes you super attractive.
Yes.
I mean, I'm sure that's probably the reason why you got the attention that you did. That's, That's sort of the recipe.
Yeah.
No pun intended.
Yeah. No, for sure. Yeah. No, it's really about, yeah, because I mean, that's the thing is like their brands, you know, there are plenty of brands who have way higher AUV than we do. But also, you know, our margin profile is probably similar with us when we have much lower AUV. And you know, their build outs are probably a lot more expensive for those guys with a bigger space. And so inherently it just makes our brand's risk reward a little bit better, given we can start smaller with a little bit of low risk of failure, right? And it buys us time to get more exposure to kind of really start growing, right? Because one thing that I think we've done really well is, and we've really, really been focusing on it, is we have never raised money at the corporate level, ever. Like, we've grown organic. So we've had a few investors at the beginning who invested at the store level, right? 20% of a store for the first few stores, but we've never actually taken an investment as a company. So, you know, we essentially got our growth from a food truck all the way to where we're now. And so, you know, we know that journey. I know that journey very well of just trying to balance growth, you know, and making sure that your infrastructure solid, this and that. And I'm still learning every day. There's a lot to learn. But, you know, for me, like, I think, and this is me speaking from kind of my former investor hat. And, you know, I've managed.
Which is helpful.
Yep. Because, and look, I've, you know, in my previous job, I used to manage hundreds of millions of dollars. It was at my fingertip that I could, you know, that I can make calls on. And a lot of the mistakes, I would say, one of the biggest mistakes that companies make when they're doing well is they start growing too fast and start growing for growth's sake. And that's when really ruin somebody's brand. And so we have, you know, consciously really dialed our growth down. I think we could have grown a lot faster, but, you know, that's, you know, what I talk to, you know, when I talk to my team, it's, look, there are drivers that tick an industry, you know, and in the restaurant space, it really comes down to AUV and margins. And it's not about how many stores you have. No one cares. Investors don't care.
No.
Nobody else cares. No. Like, how has your company valued on? No, it's not really valued on. Yes, it has a function in there, but a lot smaller than you think, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, is that where they were at when they, you said they had a bunch of stores when you kind of went in there and stepped in a little bit? Was that where they were at? They were just kind of opening up stores because they thought that was the right thing to do? What was their logic behind that?
Look, I think there wasn't enough time spent on, okay, do we need to open a store? Should we? Like, what should our priorities be? And generally, I think when people, you know, it's not just for restaurant, any business for that matter, when they start, you know, when the business starts doing well and growing, the first thing you think about is, okay, when's my next location? When's my next location? Instead of, okay, when do I hire a training team? Right. It's just naturally that's how we think, because we equate the next location equals more money. Right. And that's natural.
Yeah.
And it is true to a certain extent. But, you know, there are times where you have to really dial down growth. And that's what I tell my team. You know, if I'm not seeing these metrics here, I'm going to stop growth next year. I don't care. I'm not going to open any more stores. Right. Right. And I'm very firm about that.
Smart. Yeah, right.
And so
now that you have all these systems in place, and you know, what was the Shark Tank move about? Like, how did you guys did you position, was that your strategic move or how'd that come about?
Yep. So this is what happened. So, you know, this is when I used to be an investor, I would go to, you know, these meetings with all the, you know, executives of the company, the C-levels. And one of the questions you ask is, hey, what keeps you up at night, right, about this business? And for me, what kept me up at night was obviously given, you know, the nature of the industry itself, where there's really no barriers to entry, right? even though we've been working on this so long, we've taken a lot of time because we didn't raise a lot. We didn't raise money. And so we've been doing organically and taking the slower growth route. My biggest fear was that somebody would copy our brand, go out, raise $50 million, and essentially become the first mover of this Korean barbecue in a cup brand, right? And that's what kept me up at night. And I was talking to, you know, Jung, our founder, and I said, man, that's what really keeps me up at night. Like, we got to figure something out. We need to somehow get some really good national exposure. And Jung was like, oh, that's easy. I was like, what? We need to get on Shark Tank.
He's going
to
dance.
He's like, we need to get on Shark Tank. I was like, and at first I was like, what?
Yeah.
And then I was like, you know what? How do you even get on there? But that's probably good.
Exactly.
And so.
Yeah. I mean, sit in front of a board of investors. I mean, a room full of investors like that. I mean, yeah, that's, I saw the beginning. You guys had to show up and dance, but I mean, that's what you got to do.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's part of it.
Yeah. And so we just applied and like the process is like very long and there's a lot in between, but like that very first application you put in, it's like two questions. And it's like, is this even like a legit like Shark Tank application? Like, I don't. And we're like, I guess. And it looks like it. So we put in the application. And I think we heard back like 2-3 months after, we got a call and said, hey, you guys are kind of like invited to the next round, essentially.
Wow.
And so, you know, we went through the process. And, you know, did all of that. And yeah, it was an awesome experience. I honestly loved every minute of it. I mean, you air for what, like 10 to 15 minutes, but you're in the room for a while. Like we were in there well over an hour,
So the questions were probably significantly more intense.
Yes, for sure.
And during that time.
For sure.
Oh, thank God you were there.
Yeah, I was like, yo, bring it on. Bring it on. Let me tell you what I know, okay? but it did help.
Well, that's,
you know, because I was an investor, and that's all I did essentially since college is looking at investments. And so it helped me definitely be able to frame, you know, what they want to hear, what we're doing well, what we need to highlight, right? Things like that.
Yeah, because you know that's a kind of a match made in heaven because you can speak to the numbers, he can speak to the volume of the food, right? And I think that's a sort of a dream scenario.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of restaurants probably get up there and just talk about the food and the food and the food. These guys are way too savvy to see past that in 3 seconds, right? So what would you think was, I mean, for those who don't know, every one of the sharks made an offer, correct?
Yeah.
So then what was ultimately, do you think, something that made the thing that made them say, hey, you know what, I'm all over this, but we all want it? What do you think was it?
I think a few things, but what I was able to, I think, convince them was, number one, hey, look, your risk is very low here. You know why? Because we survived from a food truck till here. And at that point, I think when we were at like 27 locations. Like, this is what I told them. And I think they understand just because they know the different industries and they know how tough food is. This is what I told them. I said, look, what do you think is harder? Getting from a food truck to 27 locations or getting from here to getting to 500 locations?
Yeah, right.
Like, the former is way harder, in my opinion. Way harder.
Significant.
So, oh, my God. So essentially what I told them is like, look, the business is already de-risked for you. We have great cash flow profile, and you can see the growth that we've had, especially on, you know, same store sales and AUV growth. We have the margin profile. We understand what ticks, you know, what makes the industry tick here, and we're taking the right steps, you know. And I think it also persuaded. I think it also helped that I left a, you know, what some people would, you know, consider to be a very prestigious, you know, a job to say, you know what, I believe in this. We're going to take this into a national brand and we're making it happen. We're going to do it. And I think that's what convinced them.
I think that's a lesson in being prepared for investors, yeah. right? I think a lot of times you had mentioned before that 7 units was sort of a pivotal point. I've heard it before that 3 units is kind of like that ugly yeah. duckling stage because you can't yeah. really like, are you making money? Can't really split yourself into three. If you have 2 partners, right? Like that becomes a little bit trickier. Yeah. But I think when you step in front of investors, people don't, whether it's Shark Tank or some yeah. like high net worth individual, I think you better have your shit together. Yes. Otherwise, they could be over very yeah. quickly.
Just know, and it just takes a little bit of research, right? Just know they're always, you know, we call these KPIs or whatever, right? These factors these metrics that are very important for the industry, right? And every industry has different metrics that are important, but you know, for restaurants, it really does come down to, because it's a high fixed cost business in general, it also has very high operating leverage, right? It's almost like an airline, right? You got to run it no matter what, right? And yeah, in the good times, you're making a ton. In the bad times, you're not making much, right? And so sales will solve a lot of times 90% of your problems, but also a lot of times masks 90% of your problems when your sales are really good, because you think you're crushing it. But then when the sales come down, you start figuring out all these issues that just come up to the surface. And I was like, wow, all these sales were hiding all of that, right? So it's kind of a double-edged sword. But so that's why people focus so much on AUV, and that obviously helps with the margin profile, right? So.
Because you guys were kind of established. So, I mean, the way I see it now, knowing a little bit more about your story, is it would have been nice to have, but you didn't necessarily need.
Yeah, we were
this to launch your brand,
right? We were absolutely committed to getting this thing done. That's why we went to the board before getting on Shark Tank, and Jung and I made sure, because what we didn't want to do was get on the show just for publicity, get the deal done, and have no intentions of actually going through with it. Like, we didn't want – it's just not who we are, and it just didn't jive well with us. So before we went on, we met with the board and said, whatever we agree to, we're going to commit to go through with the deal. Like, and we need everybody's buy-in. And we got the buy-in from everybody. That's why we went on the show. But it was just – all the terms were just – yeah, we couldn't – we were just not in that. We're just like, you know what?
Yeah. Smart. I mean, that's another lesson, right? Like, I mean, it's not, there's so much more to it than just the money. Yeah. Not all money is equal, right? I mean, you could have got money from somebody else with a lot less term or.
Oh, for sure.
So now that, that's, I mean, Mark Cuban's great, but he's also not going to put himself in a position of too much exposure or risk. I mean, despite what you were saying before. So now you've decided to franchise the concept. Yes. Tell me about what that's involved. What's involved in all that?
So. You know, there are different ways to go about it, right? And I'm just purely speaking from a business model perspective. So you can go the corporate route, you can go franchise, and you can do both. And for us, I would say we will be doing both. Like, we have no intentions to stop building corporate. Like, majority of our stores right now are still corporate. And we will continue to build corporate stores. And, you know, now that we've kind of gotten, you know, we're getting filled up in Utah, our Utah market for sure. And so, you know, our corporate stores, Jung and I, we just visited San Antonio earlier last week. And very likely corporate will start getting into San Antonio. And we're going to open a lot of stores there. Because what we also don't want to do is, okay, you know, we want more sample of stores, and look, we're profitable, and you know, we're just putting money where our mouth is. We keep building our stores, but it also aids to help build the brand and the exposure as well, because it does take a lot longer to grow, just doing the corporate model, right? Unless you take. A massive investment from McDonald's like Chipotle did, right? Like, that's one route, but, franchise, is from a business perspective, honestly, it's a superior model at the end of the day, because what matters at the end of the day is returns, money on money returns, and it's a royalty model, right? And so, it has lower risk, right? What it doesn't have is, right now, when we build our corporate stores, we're way more profitable, because even though we spend our capital, right, we take all the margins that we make, right? Instead of just the royalties. And so, you know, that's why we continue to, you know, we continue to build corporate stores. We do have one franchisee that was grandfathered in from the very early days. You know, there.
So he negotiated like some sort of potential.
Way back when it was well before I joined. We had one franchisee that was grandfathered in, and you know they have a store opening today at Tempe, Arizona. Wow. In the last 4 weeks, they had four openings. In the last 4 weeks, they had an opening every week. And so they've kicked the gear, because when I joined, they had one store 3 years ago, and they recently raised, I think, $10 million to, you know, build Cup Op stores. And now they're on their 19th store now. So they've definitely been building, and it's been good. It's good to have work with, you know, a franchisee that, you know, that's been working with us for a long time. And we learn a lot, right? Because there's a lot to be learned about, you know, franchising. It's very different from just opening corporate stores. And so, you know, we're doing that. We're learning a lot. That's kind of the thought, is that how do we get the best of both worlds, of where, you know, we continue to open corporate stores and get that cash flow upside. But while making sure that we can do it at a sufficient speed where we grow our brand and presence, because it's just, food is just such a tough, you know, business model. At the end of the day, the only thing that will save you is your brand. And, you know, to have that, people need to know you, people need to hear about you. And, you know, having your stores, you know, more stores and having more exposure, you know, goes a long way. So that's how we came to that decision.
And how do you guys go about identifying new markets and new real estate opportunities?
Great question. Honestly, new markets, this is my thinking, right? So we're Korean food, right? But our food is also, you know, it's a new style. It's not authentic Korean food, right? It's just not. It's not authentic Korean food. When I was looking at, you know, the QSR industry, it's crazy to think that, like, even in the top 100 QSR, there's only one Asian brand, which is Panda Express. And it's like, wow, there's only one among, you know, so many dozens of burger chains, pizza chains, sandwich chains. There's only one Asian cuisine. And number one, that tells me that there's opportunity there, because it's an underserved market, but there is secular growth in that market, you know, demand for, you know, Asian concepts. And looking at Panda, my hat's off to Panda. I mean, those guys are just pioneers, honestly. Huh. I'm like, wow.
I can tell you. So that's the space that I'm in. So I was in the restaurant business for 20 years, and now I work I do real estate for emerging restaurants. Yeah. And one of our clients is Panda Express. So my partner represents them here in New York City.
Yeah.
They are so intense.
Oh man.
Extremely intense. I mean, it's the kind of place where the founder will be outside of one of the New York City locations, sweeping the street and greeting customers. Not saying I mean, they're intense. And I mean, what is it, 2,000 locations or something like that across the country? Yeah. It has been no small feat. I mean,
goodness.
On it.
And,
they're on top of it.
And look, like, they're the pioneers in the space. And obviously we look up to them. How did they do it? How did they do it? And it's interesting. It's, you know, the irony in this whole thing is Panda was able to become a national brand in the U.S. because it's not authentic Chinese food. You know, in the way that Cup Op is not authentic Korean. And so for me, when I'm looking at that, and it goes back to your question of how do you look into new market, geography, things like that. Number one for me is competition. It's like, look, if I go to New York, it's a different market. It's people, like, as far as what they eat, right, they're a lot more diverse. They're a lot more adventurous. Mm-hmm. And it's just a lot more, their palates are a lot more sophisticated in general, right? Mm-hmm. And New York's all about, and look, in those big cities, it's not about QSR chains. It's not about these chains. It's more about these one-off restaurants that are just a Michelin star, this and that, awesome chef, yeah. Right? And that's, you know, that's what drives the demand. And the competition is just off the charts. And, you know, rent, you know, we don't even want to talk about rent in New York. You and I both know. Yeah. You know, California, same thing. There's so much both authentic fusion Korean food available in LA. It's like, why would I go there?
Yeah.
Like it's just, yeah. I'm literally going into that's a burning smart. Pit. Like, why would I do that? You know, that's just, yeah,
you
so
open yourself up to those folks who are like purists, exactly. Right? Like it's the same thing, but it's the same thing with like Italian.
Yeah.
You know, they complain about pizza. That's not authentic. I think, you know, Domino's Pizza, Papa exactly. John's are doing just fine.
Exactly.
Right? Like, you know, it doesn't have
to, exactly.
Yeah. So,
And so geography wise, you know, and markets, you know, I think it says a lot that we hit it out of the park in Utah, right? And, you know, we're getting, you know, very good response from all the neighboring states, right? In Idaho, Arizona just had a massive grand opening in Tucson.
Yeah.
One of the best we've had.
I imagine.
And we are in, you know, Colorado, we're in Nevada, and now we're in Oklahoma as well. And so kind of our strategy right now is middle of the country and the South, and Texas we'll be getting into. And so I, because for me, there. In my opinion, it's like, you're not going to be a national brand, especially in the QSR space, without getting the middle of the country and the South. Because that's where the concentration is the highest.
A lot of real estate.
Yeah. And that's where concentration is the highest, too. For QSRs and fast food.
I mean, here in New York, there's so many restaurants, but there are thousands of restaurants in the Midwest that that are multiple units, right? That I have, I mean, more beyond hundreds of units that I've probably never heard of.
Yeah.
You know, that's a big swath of land, as I say. So now that you're looking at these new markets, and I completely agree with you. I mean, there's no reason to open yourself up to that. But I mean, to like the stuff on the coast, but I do think you guys would have, you know, New York City lunchtime crowd.
For sure. I think the conversation would be different if it was our 200th store versus our, like, you know.
Yeah.
I think that's the difference. It's like, why do we prioritize now? I fully intend to have cup-up stores in New York and in California and in L.A. in the future.
Yeah, just not right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, smart. So – you're looking for franchisees now. Is that the goal? How is that going so far?
So this is and this is one nice thing that we have is that we can really take our time to look for our partners, right? That's how I think about it. And for us, we're not interested in really working, you know, with somebody who will, you know, open one store because it makes it hard for us to manage. I'm trying to find a fine balance of both worlds where we minimize the downsides of the franchise model while being able to capture the upside. And, you know, one clear downside of the franchising model is that you lose control, right? Over time, you lose control.
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
and that's more prevalent if I open 500 stores with 500 different franchisees that I all have to interact with. Yeah. If I'm talking to five groups that own, you know, 100 each, and let's say corporate at that time is 200, that makes my life a lot easier. It's a lot easier to manage, you know, quality. It's a lot easier to manage just overall. And so that's kind of what we're looking at is we're, you know, and we don't have a store count number on it. It's really just, number one, the most important thing is operating experience. You know, because whoever operates in restaurants, I mean, that makes or breaks the restaurant 100%. And so number one is operating experience in the restaurant industry, right? And number two, somebody who knows their market very well and somebody who can fill up a market, right? And some markets may be only three stores, right? But you know, but a lot of markets are 10, 15, 20 stores, right? And so we're looking for somebody who has both that operational, you know, capability and somebody who can not only just, you know, build one, but be able to fill up a market to be able to really kind of own that market. And so we've, you know, we haven't been, you know, actively, you know, reaching out really yet. We get a lot of franchise inquiries. And you know, one funny thing about Cup Up is when Cup Up was just a food truck, a major broadcasting station in Korea came out and did a documentary on this food truck in the middle of nowhere, just making noise. And that documentary it was uploaded on the YouTube and it went viral on social media in Korea. And so people know us better actually in Korea than they do here, even though we have no stores there.
That's incredible. And so there's probably like, wow, look at this. Korean food in the United States. Yeah, I would imagine.
So you can imagine that. Especially how many Koreans may have reached out to us who live in the States wanting to open Cup Up. You know, but we've, you know, and look, we could have, and we could have probably, if we said, you know what, let's do it. Let's just take all these inquiries and let's start, whoever can open, whoever has the financial, you know, means to be able to do it, let's do it. We probably would be in hundreds of stores by now. But, you know, it goes back to making sure that, you know, you're prioritizing what matters, what ticks, and, you know, in a way that is the best for your brand. And the last thing I wanted to do is open up a bunch of franchises when you're not ready and just ruin your brand. And also, I mean, you're dealing with hard-earned savings of these people who may have saved all their lives for this. And I don't ever want to think about, I don't think I would be able to sleep at night knowing that we just made their life way worse by building a Cup Up store. And for me, it's always been, we're not ready. We're not ready. We're not ready. We're not ready. And now is finally, I think, you know, we'll end this year at 47 stores. I think we have enough experience, at least under our belt, to be able to say, okay, all right. I think we're ready. And we can work with for me, it's, I don't have a deadline or timeline of, okay, this is how many franchises I want to get, how many I want to open. I don't have any of that. It's more of, can I find the right partners? And if we can, then we will work with them.
Yeah. Well, you're entrusting your baby to them, right? I mean, it's a big responsibility on your end, and you have the responsibility of delivering, like you said, to these. So we do a lot of franchise work with Fat Brands.
Yeah.
So Fat Brands, thousands of franchisees. You would have the guys down in Texas who have 75 Bojangles, 25 Wingstops and this. And then you would have the couple in Washington, D.C. who put their 300 grand together and they're ready to do it. Two completely different experiences, both heavy responsibility, right? One's going to be very demanding. They know what's up. The other one is going to be very needy. They want everything taken care of. It's a lot of responsibility. So I applaud you for taking that on. It's not easy. And I know it's, I don't know. I mean, I was a chef. I know chefs are known for not wanting to let go, but handing that off is, you've seen it since the inception. So you're entrusting people with a lot. So that's the way to go. It's the way to grow. Like you said,
we want to make sure they succeed. Right. Cause we only succeed if they succeed.
Yeah.
And so,
of course.
And that's why we've held off because we want to really prove out our model through our stores to make sure that we're confident that, you know, the capital we put in will be returned.
Okay. And now if somebody wants to be considered as a franchisee, where can they go?
They can, on the website, you're able to leave a message. The email is info@cupoptruck.com. It's still truck because, you know, we started from a truck. But it would be info@cupoptruck.com would be
very cool.
The franchise inquiries. Another thing, actually, and this not many people know, we have a lot of stores in Indonesia. And people don't know. We actually have 140 stores in Indonesia.
Franchises?
It's a partnership. But this is another great story. So this is what happened. So
that's amazing.
When our founder was running the truck, and it was like in his second year, just still running that truck, these two students from, you know, University of Utah. You know, these two brothers, they would come eat at the kebab truck every time it showed up. Okay. And they asked they asked Jung one day, they said, "Hey, we want to take this to Indonesia." And Jung's like, "I have a truck. Like, we can't take this truck.
As far as I know, we can't. We can't get it there.
We can't take this truck to Indonesia. But how about this? I'll tell you what. Let me work on my business for the next year. I'll work really hard. If you still feel the same, let's talk in 12 months, okay? See you guys." Okay?
Smart.
They keep coming to eat kebab. A year later, they show up again. And when they're eating kebab, they said, "Jung, the time is now.
It's been a year.
The time is now. It's been a year. We're still up for it. We want to do it. We're passionate. Come to Indonesia with us." And Jung's like, "Oh my goodness. Okay, fine." So they go to Indonesia together. Turns out, these two brothers, their family, you know, is essentially, their family owns one of the biggest conglomerates in Indonesia. They're like, I think, the 10th largest in Indonesia. And they're, I think, the biggest in F&B. And Jung was like,
"Oh my God.
Whoa, whoa, Utah. Whoa, what is going on here? What is going on here?" And
that's a scary place.
Yeah,
to be.
And they,
it's intimidating.
Yeah, and they met with, Jung met with their uncle, who is a CEO of the company, who is a multi-billionaire, and just shook hands and said, "Okay, we're partners now." And they started
a little different than the Cuban experience.
And they started building kebab stores out there. And you know, through the pandemic, the reason they have so many stores now and they were able to grow really fast is, you know, they have around 20 kebab only stores, and they continue to grow that. What they've also been able to do is they own a boba brand called Cha Time. I think they operate, you know, 600 and something stores in Indonesia. And through the pandemic, you know, it's a boba concept. They said, "You know what? We should put kebab street food, like Korean street food menu, in here." And so what they started doing is retrofitting their existing stores, putting kebab and Cha Time, and putting these street food menus in there. And so bam, 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 they probably opened one yesterday and I don't even know about it. Like, that's last amazing. Time I checked on
it. So they just license out the name?
Mm-hmm. So we're a partner. Wow. So we're a partner. You know, we both own shares in this entity. You know, they are the best people. I mean, just such good people. Jung and I were just out in Indonesia a few months ago, about 3 months ago. It was so awesome to just drive down and see, oh, there it is. That's kebab. Oh. There's kebab. It's just such a cool experience. And so, you know, I talked to them a amazing. Lot. I was chatting with them last night. They're crushing it. F&B Indonesia. That's their company. F&B Indonesia. Crushing it right now. So
that's like the dream there. So does that lead to any more potential international expansion, or is that gonna stop there?
Look, like, never say never, but let's just say this. Yeah. We're not actively looking. Right. Just because, look, there's so much to do in the U.S. And we just, if anything, we just lucked out big time with these guys in Indonesia because they're such rock stars. But look, like, we got to work with the resources that we have and making sure that we maximize, you know, what we get out of our resources. And right now our focus is in the U.S. So.
All right.
If a great opportunity comes, like Indonesia. Then who knows, right? But we're not active.
You're open-minded. Yep. You're open-minded, yeah. Not exactly exploring the market, as they say. So, all right. So we're at the end of the show, but I have three questions. I usually end the show, everybody gets the same three questions.
Love it.
So
fire away. Let's go.
Okay. What restaurant what restaurant am I going to find you in on your day off?
Oh, man. My favorite restaurant here is called Don Hawkins Street Taco.
Don Hawkins?
Yeah, it's a local brand here. And it, oh, I go there. I could eat there 3 times a week. I just love that place. Their tacos are just so, it's just so good. And so you're gonna go
there right after this, aren't you?
Probably am. So I was actually just talking about them this morning too to somebody. Somebody actually asked me, "What's your favorite restaurant in Utah?" This morning I was like, oh, "You know what it is," you know. So shout out to them. Love you guys. You guys are awesome. Keep doing what you're doing. You bring me a lot of happiness.
There you go. I love that. So now that's like your go-to lunch spot, dinner spot, doesn't matter, just when you are hungry.
Both. I'm just like, and on the weekends, on Sundays, I'm like, we got to go grab some of these tacos because they're so good.
Amazing. Yeah. All right. So local brand. Yeah. That's, I love the supporting the local brand. And what about on the national level? Any like favorite QSR restaurant concepts, any kind of like national, doesn't have to be food necessarily. Yeah. Like you mentioned a bubble tea.
Yeah. Honestly, I gotta look, people give, you know, Panda a lot of bad rep, but I gotta give it to Panda just because I learned so much from them and I have a lot. Mm. I have a great deal of respect for Panda. To be able to do what they've achieved when there was no one to look at back then, it's just, I think, you know, I look up to them and they're somebody that I track very closely. Honestly, and I'll give you a great example. And it goes back to your earlier question of how do you locate a site? This is what I found to be the most effective. I go into, for example, San Antonio. We flew into San Antonio. I search a bunch of pandas. I go in. I talk to the managers. I let them know, hey, you know, we run a concept called Kupbap. We're a, you know, Korean barbecue, quick casual brand. We're new to the state. We're trying to make our way in here. We don't know very much about the San Antonio market. Can you, you know, give us some pointers on what markets are good, this and that? And the data that you get from them is the best primary research one could do. Better than any software. It's just right on. You know.
Can I go? I'm gonna give you my little hack too that I use for a similar thing for clients. Okay. So in that experience, right? I'm you, I wanna go check out a new market for my restaurant at the time or for a client. I'll go in there at the end of the day and I'll order. And I'll look at, and I said, can I get a copy of the receipt? Actually, I'm going to expense this for work or whatever. And I get a copy of it and I look at the order number and I look about how much I spent and I'll say, okay, this is order number 350 for the day.
You know what? Somebody just told me that the other day in San Antonio, actually.
Oh yeah. There you go. That's the move. So even if you get a bottle of water, you can probably do the math and figure it out and get close.
And so, to your question, Panda, and honestly, another brand, just because, you know, and they are the gold standard, as you know, Chick-fil-A. And the reason being is, like, our biggest focus at Kupbap is culture. Because that's how we got the customers to look at us in the first place. Absolutely, by that energy, by that friendliness, you know, all of that. And so, and we know it's a lot easier to scale processes than culture. Like culture is just, it is just so hard. But that is one thing that we will never, ever give up on. And looking at Chick-fil-A and being able to say, how did they do it? Like, how did they actually get that culture throughout? Because if you look at almost any national brand, they've all given up on actual corporate-wide, like store-wide culture you can actually feel, right? But Chick-fil-A has been able to execute on that. And so they're a great case study that we look up to, that we do a lot of studying on too. So,
yeah. I mean, growing concepts, I think, you know, they're always worried about the supply chain. Can we replicate this? The taste, the quality, everything over there. But to me, the culture and the vibe and the experience is much more difficult to
exactly.
Replicate. Yeah. Okay. All right. Next question. Now, you and I are traveling, right? We're in a city. And our phones die, or like it's whatever, 1995, we get lost, and I gotta go find you.
Yeah.
What kind of restaurant or bar would I find you?
Honestly, you probably would find me at like a Korean street food, comfort food type of a restaurant. That's where I would be. All right. And they're two actually two different answers, and it's either that or, funny enough, and people are gonna, you know, they might point finger at me, but McDonald's, you might find me at McDonald's. I think you might. It's probably
I love the confession.
It's probably Korean street food, or you'll see me grabbing a hot and spicy McChicken at McDonald's. Like,
I love
just
that.
Because. And you know what? It's so interesting. You know why? Because look, like, there's so many burger chains, right? And like, if I had a McDonald's burger right next to, let's say, In-N-Out. Like, In-N-Out, clearly, for me at least, everybody's different, is a better tasting, higher quality burger every time. Mm-hmm. But I like look back and it's like I go to McDonald's more often than I do almost any other fast food brands. And I'm like, whoa, what's going on? Why? It's so interesting. Why? Because I feel like I would pick In-N-Out every time. And I think it has to do with the fact that, yeah, I just grew up eating it. And so it's almost like it just becomes a habit comfort. And comfort. That's why, you know, and that it's just like it was mind boggling for a second. I was like, why is that? You know, so it's either it might be, at, you know, Korean street food or some McD's.
I don't know about that. I have a hot take because we don't have too many In-N-Outs. We have no In-N-Outs here on the East Coast, but I have been out there on the West Coast. I am shocked, and you can tell me if you think differently, at how horrible the French fries are at In-N-Out.
In-N-Out fries aren't very good. I agree.
Right?
And as long as you would agree that at least you got to give it to McDonald's that their fries are actually really good. I don't know what they put in there, but it's good. I don't know.
We don't know. They got in a lot of hot water for, what was that, the beef fat a couple of years ago? Is that what it was? Yeah. But it's all right. Okay. All right, so last question.
Yes.
One meal.
Yes.
Three people. Who are the people, and where are you eating? Anybody in the world. It could be people you know, famous people, dead people, fictional people. Who are you going to have the dinner with, and where are you going to
eat? That's a great question. I would say one person would be Obama. I don't know. He's just such a charismatic person. I like him. I don't know.
I don't want to cut you off, but I can't tell you how many times he comes up.
I don't know. You just want to talk to him. Him and Elon Musk, I would say. I mean, as cliche as it is, I want to pick his brain. Yeah. And know it's like, hey, like, how do you actually – because, like, he's just so ahead. Right. And it's like, how does your brain work? I just want to pick his brain. Right.
So the Elon Musk and Barack
probably.
Obama.
Yeah. And we'll eat. I got to introduce him to Korean food. I got to represent. Right. And so
who's the third person?
Oh, I thought I was the third person.
One more. No. You four people altogether. You and three people.
That's a great question. The last person, who would it be? You know what? Yes, I know. There's this spiritual leader and like a philosopher, Eckhart Tolle. He's a very famous person. He wrote one of my absolute favorite books, called The Power of Now.
Oh yeah. I have it right over here.
Yep. Great book. You know, it's all about focusing on the present. You know, and you know, I'd love to be able to actually talk to him. I listen to him a lot. I listen to all of, you know, his, you know, the talks he gives, things like that. He helped me a lot in my stressful finance days. Let's just say that when I was losing, you know, a lot of money sometimes, you know, I would just, you know, put on my, you know, AirPods and listen to him. And say, you know what, let's focus on the present, let's stop worrying about things that hasn't happened yet and engulf my life with things that haven't actually happened yet. You know, we need to stop, we got to clear everything out, right? And so he's been a very influential person.
Interesting. Well, that's going to be a very heavy conversation. So where are you going
to
eat?
It's got to be Korean food, man. It's got to be. I got to introduce him to some Korean-style pork belly, samgyeopsal. You know what I mean.
Oh,
you know,
man.
Can't go.
Yeah, I do know.
Can't go wrong with that one. You and I both know.
You cannot. No. You're gonna have me going down to the Lower East Side to get some Korean barbecue after this.
Yep. So which spot do you go to?
Korean barbecue? Man, there are, I mean, you know, and like you said, in New York City, it is so, you know, it's, you want to go to, there's 10 different Korean barbecue places.
Yes, there are too many. And K-Town, I feel like, is so packed now.
Yeah. It's, you know, it ultimately, and now you're even seeing it on menus.
Yes, that's true.
It's being featured on menus.
Yeah.
There's a place in Flushing.
Yes. Queens. Oh, Flushing is my. I would probably take them to Flushing, dude, because they have sick Korean barbecue at way cheaper prices than the city, the way.
And it's usually like underground. You know, that type of like Anthony Bourdain style. Yep. I don't even know the name. Mappo is one, I think, over there.
Yep. Yep. I know what you're talking about. Baekjeong's there.
There's a whole bunch. And I mean, I know that, what's his name, did a, he did a special on Queens and Parts Unknown, that if anybody, to me, if you want to go pick apart Korean barbecue, that's where you start. Forget about Manhattan. You my wife is Colombian. Also a lot of Colombian food.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. So I loved going to Flushing. I used to always frequent Flushing. So.
That's the spot. Well, if you come back out here, let me know. We'll go on the Bourdain tour.
Sounds good, man. That is, I definitely miss, I don't miss the rent in New York, but I do miss New York. New York's a very special place. It has a very special place in my heart. So,
yeah, we say it all the time. You know, we travel quite a bit, my wife and I, and I'm, get so excited, like, oh, we're going to New Orleans, or we're going, you know, we're going to Dallas. What's going to be the, we're going to Chicago. What's the food going to be like? But we take New York for granted. We're a 25-minute train ride. And we just don't even think about how great it really is.
You know, like, I've lived in New York, you know, over 7 years, you know, and I've never been to the Empire State. Actually, funny thing, before I moved back to Utah, like 2 days before I went to look at the Statue of Liberty, I was like, I gotta do the tour because I've never done it. Yeah. You know, but you take it for granted and you forget about it. And man, I'm like, all the omakases. I'm like, I am just, it's like, where are they? Like, where are they? You know, I miss it, man. I really miss it. I miss my
omakases are popping up everywhere. There's a great concept. Sushi by Bao, heard of them? They're like a omakase concept, super small. They're taking like, they'll take like a storage room and turn it into an omakase, like super VIP. And they have, I think, like 45 minutes to eat. And you eat, and then they shuffle you back to the bar if you want, from the bar out to your table. But they're making these like no rent deals with landlords on these spaces. Like, hey, this, we noticed back here, they like the fact that you might have to go down like some weird alley
in the back of a
hotel or something.
That's cool.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so that's a very cool concept. So a lot of these things popping up. You know, New York is, if you don't pay attention, I mean, it's almost overwhelming to try to think of all your
food. And you know what the thing is, and that is kind of mind-boggling if you think about it, is how different markets are and how different taste buds are. Because I think, as far as I know, in all of Utah, all of the state of Utah, there are two omakase places, I think. Yeah. And one of them just started like a few months ago. So there was only one in the whole state. Think about that. So it's just something to think
they're
about.
Growing rapidly.
It's almost like a different country's almost, you know. It's crazy if you think about it, how different these markets are.
It is. I mean, it's like you said, the middle of that country, or the middle of the country is completely different from the coast. A lot of opportunity and a lot of different things to consider, both on both sides. Rent is a factor, but you know, volume, density, all that.
But another thing that you know, an advantage if you do start in New York, And if you succeed in New York, you can have one location and become a national brand.
Oh, yeah.
That's the difference, right? Like,
yeah, but yeah, you know, it costs you significantly. It does. Yeah. I mean, we were at a restaurant on the Lower East Side the other night, and the guy said, I said, wow, this is beautiful, like retrofit into the ground floor of some residential property. And I was like, well, how long have you guys been open? Like 3 years, but it took us 4 years to get open.
We'd be out of business. So that's crazy.
Right? Wow. Yeah. You know, with zoning, yeah. You know, trying to convert one space to the next, put a hole in the wall, get the venting up, and a building that was built in 1905. So, yeah, I think you're good. This is a little
bit. Yeah, I think I'm good. I think I'm good, man. I think I'm good.
Well, Doc, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. We'll definitely be sending franchisees your way via the show notes. Anything else you want to leave people with here before we sign off?
No, I just, you know, the times aren't easy. You know, in the restaurant with labor, rising, you know, inflation, and, you know, everybody's, you know, working hard. Let's all survive and thrive. All of us. Let's do it.
I love that. That's it.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thanks,
sir.
Kyle.
Speak soon. All right.
Thank you for checking out another episode of the National Restaurant Owners Podcast. If you enjoyed it and you'd like to help support the show, share it with your friends. Share it with your restaurant buddies. Share it with your people who want to be restaurant people. That'd be great. And you could post on your social too. We would love that. Tag us. We'll share it in kind, right? That's what they say. We'll share it in kind. So you share and we'll share it. And if it's not too much to ask, one other little thing or two other little things, if you could leave us a rating and review, we'd really appreciate it, because that's what kind of like bumps us up and makes us, you know, more visible to other restaurant folks who are looking for us. So that'd be great. To catch all the latest from me personally, you can follow me on Instagram at Kyle and Sarah. Also at Kyle and Sarah on Twitter and on TikTok and LinkedIn. So that's great. If you want to follow the show, it's at restaurant_owners_podcast on Instagram. Thanks again, and I'll see you next time.